If you think you might suffer from asthma, there might be good news for you. New research says a diagnostic tool could be just a drop of blood away. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you could join us today. My guests are here to tell us about a faster, cheaper, and more accurate tool for identifying asthma. Plus, they'll answer your questions about treating it. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or leave a comment on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. My guests are David Beebe, a professor and associate chair for research and faculty development in the Department of Biomedical Engineering at UW-Madison. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And also Dr. Samir Mather, associate professor in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine. And Dr. Mather, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Well, I think asthma is certainly a very common concern for adults and children alike. Dr. Mather, let's start by describing what asthma is. What do we mean when we say someone has asthma?
Sure. So asthma, basically, it's a breathing disorder where patients can experience a variety of different symptoms, things like shortness of breath. They can complain of wheezing, chest tightness, cough. All of these are symptoms that could be suggestive of asthma. It's something that tends to be found in a lot of patients that have allergic diseases. Mm. So there's a definite association between allergies and asthma, but that's not always the case. And it's basically something where, fortunately, we do have a number of different medications that can help relieve some of those symptoms. And most of those are different types of inhalers that can help help treat some of our patients.
So you said that there is a correlation for some people with allergies. What else causes asthma?
Oh, yeah. There are a number of different things. So allergies is going to be a big one, especially for allergic individuals. Upper respiratory infection, so the common cold, is a very common trigger for symptoms. Exercise can induce asthma symptoms in some individuals. A number of different irritants, things like tobacco smoke and other things in the air can trigger those types of symptoms.
And how serious can asthma be?
Well, it can be life-threatening for people that have more severe forms of the disease. When they get into environments where they are just totally surrounded by some of these types of triggers, it can be life-threatening.
And actually, I remember several years ago, a local Madison woman who was quite well-known for her activism work died from an asthma attack, and she was by herself and didn't have what she needed to counter it.
Exactly, yeah. No, that is something that unfortunately we do hear of too frequently, actually.
Mm-hmm. So. When does asthma usually come on for people?
Yeah,
or does
so,
it vary?
Well, it can vary, but for many individuals, it does start sometime in childhood or early adulthood, and that's sort of the typical allergic asthma type of picture. There also is something else called late onset asthma, where there can be individuals more in their 30s or 40s that suddenly develop asthma. Some of that can be because of occupational exposures, but there's other circumstances where it can develop at later ages. And in some of those cases, we just don't know why that happened, but we do see asthma that can start up pretty much at any age.
We're going to find out from Dave Beebe about the new diagnostic tool, but first let's talk how asthma is generally diagnosed right now. What's the process of finding out if someone actually has asthma?
Yeah, so much of it starts with the history. So we end up having to find out in detail what type of symptoms are being experienced, what types of triggers are causing those symptoms. And once we kind of have that sort of a picture, there's several different types of tests that we can perform. A lot of it has to do with breathing maneuvers. So there's something called pulmonary function testing or spirometry, which can help us see particular features of the breathing maneuver that would be suggestive of asthma. Unfortunately, these are not always 100% reliable. And so there certainly are circumstances where we can perform some of this testing and we still are not 100% sure. So asthma in general tends to be more of what we call a clinical diagnosis, where we have to put a lot of pieces together to see whether or not it seems consistent with asthma or not.
Well, and it seems like having that many different steps that you might have to go through is going to impact the care and treatment as
sure.
a result.
Sure, absolutely.
Are there cases where it's difficult to pinpoint what's going on and so treatment is delayed, or, you know, what is the impact?
Yeah, so I can tell you there's certainly some instances where, you know, we're not 100% sure is this asthma or not. And we end up basically assuming that it may be and just start somebody on empiric treatment. And the treatments include things like steroids, which have side effects, and things like albuterol inhalers. Mm-hmm. And so we may end up just starting to treat empirically without 100% knowing that is this truly asthma or not. And we kind of use that diagnostically as well. If they come back to me in a month and say, oh, yeah, you know, my symptoms are better, that ends up being more supportive of that, mm-hmm. that diagnosis.
We are talking with David Beebe today and Dr. Samir Mather. We're finding out about a new diagnostic tool for asthma and also about asthma as a condition, current options for treating, and anything that you might want to know about asthma, we'd be happy to cover. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. David Beebe, you're the co-author of a new study, and it's looking at a different way to diagnose asthma, and it's with a blood test. Now, that's quite a departure from what Dr. Mather was talking about. How did you come on the idea of being able to diagnose asthma with a blood test?
Right. So as Samir mentioned, the current techniques are typically indirect measures of airflow, but don't really get at the cell function level of the test. And my lab actually doesn't focus on asthma at all. We focus mostly on cancer biology, but we had developed some of these tools that allow us to measure in a very quantitative way the behavior of individual cells. And in discussions with Samir and others, actually a grad student that's the lead author in this, Eric Sackman, came up with the possibility that this could be applied to asthma and really provide a direct measure of neutrophils, which we hypothesized would be affected by asthma.
And what are neutrophils exactly?
So neutrophils, I guess the simplest way to think about them is they're the first responders to something going bad in the body, to inflammation or a wound or an infection.
So are they a type of white blood cell then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so you said that you generally work on cancer. Is this a technique that you've been using to work on cancer detection?
Yeah, we'd been using these tools to look at metastasis, the cells invading or cells moving, and neutrophils move very rapidly in the body. So the hypothesis then was maybe the speed and the way in which these neutrophils move is different in an asthmatic versus a normal person.
And I find it really interesting because not only is this a different way of diagnosing, but in the article that we were reading about this study, it talks about how this really could eliminate some of the kind of the subjective parts of diagnosing asthma. And one of the things that was mentioned, Samir, is that children and older people, it can be hard to get them to comply. That sounds bad, but for the test to actually be accurate when you do it with them, what are the challenges with those particular types of patients?
Yeah, so definitely the pediatric population as well as in older adults, some of the current breathing maneuvers that we try and perform, they can't be done. So especially in infants, they can certainly not cooperate with doing anything like that. So that's a perfect example where we need some other sort of means to help us, get at the diagnosis. And older patients as well, sometimes they're just not able to comply with doing that full kind of respiratory maneuver. And so, again,
and if I recall, it's kind of at least one of the tests is blowing really like as hard as you can, as long as you can.
Exactly. It's a forceful blow into basically a device that measures the airflow. Mm-hmm. And ideally, we need that to persist for a good solid 6 seconds for it to be a true, a valid test. Mm-hmm. And so if that can't be performed, it's not a reliable test for us.
Mm-hmm. So thinking of like a frail elderly person.
Sure, absolutely.
So, yeah. And obviously, like you said, an infant, you can't say, okay, blow really hard,
exactly.
Really hard. So this is really exciting just on the level of how accurate the diagnosis could be, but it's also exciting because it's much less expensive as well, potentially, if it would be used. Tell us about the Koala kit.
Right. So the Koala stands for kit on a lid assay, and it essentially, the easiest way to describe it, I guess, is it's just a couple of pieces of plastic, about 1 inch by 3 inches with some small features in it, and you essentially take literally a drop of blood and drop it onto the device, and then you put the two pieces of plastic together, And that manipulates the blood sample such that the cells are exposed to a what we call a chemoattractant, so a chemical that the cells like to go to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like giving a dog a bowl of food,
and
I guess.
And dangling a little treat in front
right.
of it.
And then we literally just put it under a microscope and watch the cells and quantify how fast and in what direction they're moving.
Okay. And it seems like this could also have really great implications for public health in kind of remote areas, whether it's rural areas in the U.S. or, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa or something. I mean, it seems like this self-contained kit could be much easier for people working out in the field.
Yeah, it is. We're actually applying some similar technologies right now in Uganda for HIV/AIDS diagnosis.
Mm. Wow. We are talking with David Beebe. He is a professor and associate chair for research and faculty development in the Department of Biomedical Engineering at UW. And Dr. Samir Mather, he's an associate professor at the UW-Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, medical director of the UW Allergy and Immunology Clinics, and chief of allergy at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Madison. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jason Butler, our on-air producer today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are talking about asthma treatment and also an exciting new diagnostic tool with David Beebe and Dr. Samir Mather. And let's go to the phones. And Kay in Madison is up first. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess my question is if it's possible to outgrow allergies and asthma. I had fairly severe asthma as a teenager and in my 20s, and I went through treatment a couple different times. And now that I'm in my 60s, I very rarely have any kind of problem. I don't even need my inhaler, except if I get a bronchitis or something. And I just wondered if that happens to many people.
All right. Thanks for that call, Kate. Dr. Mather?
Yeah, so I think that that scenario that Kay describes is something we do see not too infrequently. And so the one challenge is that there may still be some components of asthma there. And I think she kind of mentioned when she gets a bronchitis or some mm-hmm. other type of respiratory infection going on, she still may need her inhaler. And that may be sort of the sign that, well, it's still there, but it may not be as prominent and as significant an issue.
And in the case of Kay or someone like that who had it much more intensely as a younger person, could part of that be being in a different environment, living maybe not around the same allergens as she had when she was a child?
Absolutely. That certainly can be part of it. The other thing we do know is that with allergic inflammation and the types of things that happen in the body with exposure to allergens, some of those signaling pathways do become less prominent as you get older. So those can be less likely to trigger major symptoms.
All right. Thanks for that call, Kay. And let's go next to Greg in Lombard, Illinois. Hi, Greg.
Hi, and thank you very much for your show. I'm
sure.
Very interested. I had a question. I'm fascinated with the blood test. I'm in my 60s. I was diagnosed with asthma for the first time after two trips to emergency rooms in the mid-2000s. My question is this. I listened to a show on the People's Pharmacy about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And if I don't have the names wrong, if I have the names wrong, I apologize. But there was a Dr. Hahn from UW-Madison who advocated, along with a doctor from University of Colorado, a treatment, which I guess has been around but not used, using antibiotics over an extended term, which I know is controversial, mm-hmm. to actually kill the disease. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
All right, Greg, you're cutting out a little bit, so I'm going to give Dr. Mather a chance to comment on that.
Sure. So I think basically what you're talking about is there have been some studies that were done by Dr. Kahn that suggested that use of things like azithromycin or other macrolide antibiotics for long term can actually supposedly cure asthma. And it's actually been a very intriguing idea. It's something that other NIH-supported network studies have been very interested in, and they've actually done some preliminary studies to try and see whether this is actually the case. And in some of those bigger studies where we've had well-controlled subjects, it really hasn't seemed to pan out. So I think the general thinking right now is there may be a very small subset of patients that could respond to that sort of treatment, but they're very likely to be a minority. And it's certainly not going to be the magic cure for the majority of patients out there.
Well, and I guess the question I have is antibiotics are by definition anti-something living, like a bacteria or something. But it doesn't sound like that's at least the usual cause for asthma. So what would the antibiotics be working against?
Well, so the idea is that there, any type of an infection, any sort of respiratory infection can trigger asthma symptoms. So there may be this subset of individuals where there is a bacteria that's responsive to that antibiotic that may be the prominent trigger. But like I said, I think that's very unlikely to be the case for the majority of asthma sufferers.
Okay. Thanks for that call, Greg. Let's go back to the phones and Karen in Evansville. Hi, Karen.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Good. I have a question. I'm wondering if mold can trigger asthma attacks, because at my work, we've had some water damage, and it's Our work smells like mold, and I think it's coming from the carpeting.
So mold is a trigger, Dr.
Panther? The simple answer is yes, it can. So certainly if you have allergic sensitivity to mold, that can be a very easy way that it can trigger symptoms, even with very limited exposure. But just having any sort of particulate matter in the air for somebody that is more susceptible can also trigger asthma, whether or not you have a specific allergic sensitivity.
Thanks for that call, Karen. And Dave Beebe, so your test is meant to kind of avoid the situation where someone has to be experiencing symptoms to actually show up on, like, the blowing in a tube test and stuff. Would that blood test show that someone is prone to asthma, say, if it's only in the situation where it's responding to a bacteria or something like that?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, this discussion actually highlights why we need better diagnostics, not necessarily to replace current diagnostics, but to add to it, right? So as Samir mentioned, asthma is not all the same. Each patient is special and different, and the causes may be different, the mechanisms may be different. So the more we can improve diagnosis, and this is one way of doing it, the more we can stratify these patients so that even if it is only a small percentage that have this, we can find out which patients those are, what is the mechanism, and therefore give them the most appropriate treatment to avoid side effects.
And let's talk a little more about the research process. Take us behind the scenes a little bit. I'm sure it's very glamorous in the lab. How do you design studies like this?
So designing the actual studies in terms of how many patients to use and that sort of thing is fairly straightforward. There's protocols for doing that. There's a lot of regulation that goes along with it. And in fact, it takes us typically 6 months to a year just to get approval to do a study like this.
And that's after you've designed it, because that's after kind of submitting, this is what we plan to do.
Exactly. And then actually carrying it out often only takes a week or two. And then, of course, analyzing the data then probably takes months after that. So it is it's a long, involved process. The sort of the exciting parts of designing the technology and the actual study are fairly brief. And then you get into a lot of the somewhat drudgery of the mechanics of actually doing the study and analyzing the data. And then, of course, if things go well, as they did in this case, they then lead to something that really could be transformative.
You said that you submit the research or the
protocol.
Trials, the protocols for approval. To whom are you submitting those for approval?
It's something called the IRB, the Institutional Review Board. So it's a group of faculty that review all human subject trials, experiments, and to make sure that we're not taking advantage of the subject in any way, that there's no conflicts of interest, these sorts of things, and that everything's done in a safe way.
It seems like something like this, where it's just a, not even a blood draw, but just a drop of blood, you're not actually even doing anything to the subjects. You're actually just taking a little bit of blood. Does that speed things up, or is it still the same kind of level of scrutiny?
You would think it would speed it up, but it doesn't seem to.
And so for your initial research, the initial trials for this new asthma diagnostic tool, how many people were involved in as subjects?
Yeah, I think I actually don't remember the exact number, Samir may. I think it was about 30 in this first trial.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, and this first trial was done with mild asthmatics. It's one of the reasons we're so excited about this data, actually, is that it appears to be significant, even in very mild disease. And really, our initial thoughts were this might be more useful with people with more severe asthma to predict which patients are going to have catastrophic events later on.
And so what is the next step? I mean, you got positive results in the first trial. What's the next step for moving this forward and possibly getting it to the market, getting it into the hands of people like Dr. Mather?
Yeah, I think there's sort of three sort of avenues of next step. One is to write some more grants proposals now that we have this data, to get money to fund a much more full study with many more patients with different types of asthma. Secondly, we're starting to explore the use of this technology in other applications. So a pediatric physician from the University of Chicago is actually coming over in a couple of weeks. He thinks that this may be useful for diagnosing sleep apnea
in
pediatrics. And then thirdly is actually starting down the path of commercialization and trying to start to think about actually manufacturing a device, putting those protocols in place so that we could have reproducible devices that could be used for larger studies and ultimately in the clinic.
We are talking about a new asthma diagnostic tool with David Beebe. He was part of the team that worked on that and published about that. Dr. Samir Mather treats asthma and allergies. And so we're talking about all of those aspects of the topic as well. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So Dr. Mather, hearing about the potential of the kit on a lid assay, the koala test, how would that change how you diagnose and treat asthma?
Yeah, so I think David kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, where, you know, we really find that asthma has a lot of different flavors to it. It's not the same disease in every single patient. And in fact, a lot of the research that's going on right now is recognizing that there's different phenotypes of asthma. And there's a lot of work going on in understanding how the inflammation may be different in different individuals and other characteristics that sort of distinguish these different categories of asthma. And where I think Dr. Beebe's device is going to be really powerful is going to be helping us identify which group a particular patient belongs to. And we're already getting a sense that once we can identify which group of asthmatics a patient belongs to, there are very specific treatments that they may respond to. Mm-hmm. And so we may not need to stay with this one-size-fits-all type of treatment approach. That once we have ways of distinguishing the different patients, we can really customize therapy. And that's kind of a whole movement throughout medicine, this whole thing called personalized medicine. And the tool that Dr. Beebe has, I think, is a fantastic way that could be done very quickly to help us really stratify our asthma patients and facilitate getting them on the right track as quickly as possible.
So, Dave, how would the test show those different stratifications? How would it indicate, oh, this is a type A asthmatic versus a type C asthmatic?
Yeah, so this test may not do it in isolation, but it would be in combination with the existing tests, which is a bit of a challenge in that, yes, our test is pretty cheap, but it still may be needed in addition to other tests. But right now, we're looking at neutrophils, one type of immune cell. For example, the technology is perfectly capable of looking at other types of immune cells. So we may be able to stratify patients based on which type of cells, which specific types of cells respond. We can change the chemoattractant. So there are a lot of parameters that we can play with and get a lot of information. The caveat, of course, is there's a lot of studies to be done to really figure out which of those are going to be useful.
Great. Wow, it's very exciting research, I have to say. And let's go back to the phones and go to Doug in Jefferson. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Question I have is, I use a nebulizer at home. I use the Jonab. I'm on the Advair disc, and I have a rescue inhaler. Have they been coming up with anything other than these basic three things that are used for treating asthma? I know you're talking about a new way to basically diagnose it and detect it. What about in the treatment itself?
That's a great question, Doug. Thanks for calling. Dr. Mather?
So I think there's two other medications that are out there that are a little bit different than what you just described. One of them is called tiotropium, or the other name is Spiriva. Another one is called omalizumab, and the other name for that is Xolair. These are medications that you may just want to go to your whoever you see as your asthma specialist and just kind of mention and see if you might be a person that would be a good candidate for those medications. But the answer is yes, there are other different options out there, and there's a number of different products that are currently under investigation. So hopefully in the coming years we'll have even more potentials.
It might be worth mentioning, too, that more and more as medicine moves towards personalized diagnostics, personalized treatment, the diagnostics really is becoming more of an equal player with the treatment, both in terms of stratifying the patient and getting the appropriate treatment, but also the tools that we're developing help us understand the mechanisms of the disease, which could ultimately lead to new targets for new drugs.
Hmm. So it's kind of a cycle that feeds itself.
Right. Yeah.
And actually, Doug's question brought up an interesting point because we do see commercials for like once a day asthma treatments, but then there is a need for, like, I think he referred to it as a rescue inhaler for those acute situations too. So if someone has severe asthma, what kind of medications are they probably using, and what are those medications doing to protect them?
Yeah, so for our severe asthmatics, we usually have them on high doses of inhaled corticosteroids. So that's one major class. The other thing is a long-acting bronchodilator. So this is a version of albuterol, and albuterol is typically one of those rescue short-acting inhalers, but there's also a longer-acting version that we put in the controller category. And that is often combined with the inhaled steroid. So that's one of them that we very commonly will have in our severe asthmatics. Then the other types of medications that can be used, I mentioned just previously, were a long-acting version of a different sort of rescue inhaler called Atrovent, and that's the tiotropium or Spiriva. And then there's a newer medication that's not maybe that new. It's been out for almost a decade. It's called Xolair, and that's in this other category of biologic medications. Mm-hmm. It's a particular type of medication that targets a very specific molecule called IgE, and that's very much involved in allergic inflammation. And so that's another type of medication that can be used in some of our most severe asthmatics. Mm-hmm. And then finally, there's prednisone, which is the tablet version of steroids, which has a whole host of side effects. And it's something we're typically very reluctant to prescribe. But in our most severe patients, we end up in many occasions resorting to that. And this kind of gets back to what Dr. Beebe was talking about, where if we get a better handle on the specific inflammatory problems that one of our severe asthmatic patients is having, we may be able to target that particular pathway.
Is there a genetic component to asthma?
Absolutely, especially with the allergic asthmatics. So allergies in general do have a very strong genetic predisposition. And so, yes, there's a pretty strong genetic component. Hmm.
Let's go back to the phones and David in Waukesha County. Hi, David.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've suffered from asthma for about 35 years, and I wanted to ask about something I hadn't heard mentioned. The allergist that treated me had referred to it as an otolingual response. I don't know if that's just his term or what, but what it amounts to is a sudden asthmatic attack where the throat and airway swells completely shut, and you cannot breathe. I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
All right, Dr. Mather?
So it's tough for me to know exactly what you might be talking about there. There's a couple different phenomena that can be associated with allergic asthmatics. There's one that's actually called paradoxical vocal fold motion, where it's actually not necessarily anything going on in the lungs, but it can be the vocal cords that basically get shut, and so you really can't move air in and out of your lungs when that happens. I'm not sure if that's exactly what you're describing. There's another condition called angioedema, where that is actually a physical swelling in the throat that could impact breathing.
Is that more related to asthma or is that more related to allergy?
That's exactly what I was just going to say, is that both of these conditions are not necessarily related to asthma at all. They can be sort of independent things that can occur. But from what you described, those are the two things that kind of popped in my mind.
So with asthma, the inflammation is really in the lungs.
In the lungs, exactly. Okay. Exactly.
But if someone's having an allergic reaction, it could be triggering the asthma and could also be causing like the throat swelling.
Yeah, it could be triggering symptoms elsewhere. Most typically it's in the nose and sinuses.
Okay.
But, yeah.
All right. Thanks for that call, David. Let's go back to the phones and Jack in Kenosha. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Good day.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, I just want to make sure my radio was off. I've had severe asthma over the years, but only when I get a bronchial infection. I think it's usually a viral bronchial infection, and I cough so hard, and I can't stop coughing. It's not as if I can't get my breath. I simply can't stop coughing. I came in late to the program, and I was wondering, when that occurs, even if we think it's a bronchial infection, should I be taking antibiotics?
And when you get those...
A bacterial base for it.
And Jack, when you get those symptoms, do you have a doctor prescribing like an inhaler or anything like that?
Yes, I've been on albuterol and I've been on the other, I can't remember what it is because I haven't used it in so long, a once a day thing. It's a salt, I believe.
All right. Well, let's have Dr. Mather comment on that.
Yeah, so I'd have to say I don't typically prescribe antibiotics necessarily in that situation unless it's very clear that it's a bacterial process that's going on. Most commonly, it's a viral infection that usually starts things off. And in that sort of a setting, what you describe is something we call viral-induced asthma. And it's something that can respond very well to the use of different combinations of inhaled medications. And that's another thing I would just encourage you to talk to an asthma specialist about. There's a number of different options out there, but those are things that could very much benefit.
So actually, the viral-induced asthma topic is interesting because I was diagnosed with that in 1999, and I had... That year, I had two different strains of the flu within a month, and then I had another lung condition later in the year, and it was after that, and I feel like my lungs just kind of sent up the white flag and said, you know, this is too much. Pneumonia was what I had after. Yeah. Is there usually kind of, you know, a big event that will trigger viral-induced asthma and then it becomes a condition, or does it just kind of come on sometimes after a bad cold?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't really have a good answer for you there. I mean, we see kind of both scenarios where, you know, people can have, you know, no problems whatsoever with any sort of viral infections, and then there does seem to be this one sentinel event, and then after that, it seems like every single cold has caused problems. So I've definitely seen that in my clinic quite a bit. But we just don't know why or how that happened, but it is something we see.
I feel like they just couldn't recover after
all. Exactly.
We had a caller who wondered, earlier we talked about that sometimes people who have asthma as a child can outgrow it. A caller asked, can a person with late onset maybe in their 30s, grow out of asthma?
So it can happen, but it becomes less likely. So that later onset asthma tends to be one that tends to stick around and actually tends to be a little more of a severe variant of asthma. But certainly, even in that situation, you can grow out of it.
Okay, good. I'm sure that was the answer she was hoping for. Let's take one more call. Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a school crossing guard on a very busy corner in Madison, and the thought always worried me that, you know, I don't have asthma now, but would I be more susceptible to getting it? And if I did have it, would it be more likely to get worse if I had that corner, and especially in the warmer weather?
That's a great question. Dr. Mather?
So I think the way I'd answer that is if you already have asthma and you're in that situation where you're exposed to the pollution, it's very likely going to be something that's going to trigger your asthma and make it worse. But whether the pollution itself can cause the asthma itself, that is probably less likely. You know, it certainly is going to be an irritant and may cause you to have some coughing and stuff. But whether you actually develop full-blown asthma, that I think is actually more doubtful.
All right.
And the warmer weather.
Yeah, I mean, the weather itself can also be a trigger for some asthmatics, but whether it would actually trigger you to develop asthma, again, is more unlikely.
All right. Thanks for that call, Mike. And in just the minute or two we have left, David Beebe, what will we hear next from you about this study? What's the next stage of what you're working on?
I think the next stage is to really do a full study. You know, so we're Dr. Mature and I are working to propose a full study to NIH and get this actually was not funded. This original work was just sort of a skunk work project, as we call it.
Skunk work? That's a good word.
So now we have very good data, and we're quite hopeful that we'll be able to now propose a full study with a much bigger population of and a much better cross-section of patients where we can actually test this in a more realistic clinical setting.
Great. And we do have a link to the UW press release about the diagnostic tool that David Beebe is working on. The key to easy asthma diagnosis is in the blood. That link is on the Facebook page. And Dr. Samir Mather, anything we should think about in the summer? Kids are outside a lot more. They're hopefully more active. If they're kids with asthma, is there anything to be keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, so definitely pay attention to their symptoms. And if they're having wheezing, shortness of breath, or whatever, make sure they have their albuterol inhaler handy.
Okay.
That's their rescue inhaler, and it can be life-saving.
All right, and probably make sure that, say, camp counselors or babysitters...
Absolutely.
No.
Yeah, these days I think there's a lot of forms that you have to fill out before going to these camps, and you definitely want to mention the asthma component in there.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today. Really exciting developments and really good information, and I hope you'll come back and keep us updated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Beebe is a professor and associate chair for research and faculty development in the Department of Biomedical Engineering at UW-Madison. Dr. Samir Mather is an associate professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also the medical director of the UW Allergy and Immunology Clinics and the chief of allergy at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Madison. And, you know, that was all great information, and especially about keeping our kids safe. Talking now about teenagers, just about any parent will tell you that raising a teenager is tough. Among the challenges might be the fact that certain parts of the teenage brain have yet to fully form, and it might be contributing to riskier behavior. Our next guest sheds some light on the teenage brain and explains how we can minimize the risks our kids might otherwise be willing to take. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. I hope you'll stay tuned on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.